Today is Wednesday, January 14th, 2026, and you're listening to the World Socialist Website. After Venezuela, Trump targets Iran. The Imperialist Rampage Escalates, by Keith Jones. The Trump administration is preparing an imminent military attack on Iran in the next stage of a regime change operation aimed at returning the Middle Eastern country of 93 million people to neo-colonial subjugation and placing its vast oil reserve under U.S. imperialist control and domination. For days, Trump, America's fascist would-be dictator president, and his henchmen have been threatening to strike Iran with bombs and missiles under the cynical pretext of defending anti-government protesters. On Tuesday morning, in a social media post framed as a message to the Iranian protesters, Trump declared, quote, "Take over your institution. Help is on its way," end quote. This was just hours before he was to confer with top Pentagon generals and his national security staff on options for attacking Iran. Open source intelligence and flight tracking data reveal that since December, there has been a surge of U.S. war materials to the Persian Gulf region, a necessary prerequisite for waging war on Iran. Trump's attempt to depict himself as the liberator of the Iranian people is a monstrous fraud, based on the Hitlerian concept of the big lie. U.S. imperialism never reconciled itself to the mass uprising that overthrew the tyrannical regime of the Shah in 1979. It has mounted a decades-long campaign of threats, military aggression, and economic warfare against Iran and its people. In 2018, Trump torpedoed the UN-backed Iran nuclear accord and unilaterally imposed crippling sanctions, subsequently reinforced under the Democrat Biden, with the avowed aim of crashing Iran's economy and bringing about regime change. Washington's desired outcome has always been driving the Iranian people into deprivation and misery. The sanction-enforced cutoff of access to drugs and advanced medical devices has alone caused tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of premature deaths. As always, the U.S. corporate media are all reading from the same script, dictated from the White House. They question nothing, investigate nothing. Less than 2 weeks ago, Washington illegally attacked Venezuela, killing more than 80 people, kidnapped its president, and seized what are the world's largest oil reserves. In the weeks preceding, the media repeated the administration's transparent lies that President Nicolas Maduro headed a narco-terrorist regime, just as they breathlessly repeated the claims of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney regarding Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction in the run-up to American imperialism's 2003 invasion of Iraq. Now Trump, his Democratic Party enablers, and the media would have us believe that Iran is in the grip of a popular uprising that is being brutally crushed by the Iranian authorities. This is the new manufactured casus belli. It replaces that used to justify last June's 12-day U.S.-Israeli war on Iran that killed more than 1,000 people, and which Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu invoked when they held a war conclave at Mar-a-Lago on December 29th, the threat supposedly posed by Iran's civilian nuclear program. No doubt there is widespread anger and dissatisfaction with Iran's clerical-led bourgeois nationalist regime, which represses any form of working-class political self-expression and has systematically dismantled the social concessions made to the working people in the immediate aftermath of the 1979 revolution that overthrew the tyrannical, monarchical dictatorship of the Shah. But the protests now unfolding in the streets of Iran are not a movement of and for the working class. This is attested by their social composition, absence of any demand to address the pressing socioeconomic problems facing Iran's workers and rural toilers, and the lack of any organized working class intervention in the form of mass strikes. The protests were initiated by the Bazaari, that is, a section of the bourgeoisie and petty bourgeoisie comprised of moneylenders, merchants, and shopkeepers, and have taken on an ever more explicit right-wing, pro-imperialist character akin to the Color Revolution, instigated by American imperialism and agents in Ukraine, Georgia, and elsewhere. The operatives of the CIA and other imperialist intelligence agencies are manifestly present and playing a major role in inciting violence, alongside such foreign-based imperialist operatives as the Shah's son, the Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, who late last week urged protesters to press for the government's overthrow by, quote, seizing and holding city centers. On Thursday, Israel's far-right heritage minister, Amichai Eliyahu, boasted that Israeli agents are operating on the ground in Iran. As in 1953, when the CIA and Britain's MI5 organized the coup that overthrew Iran's elected president, the nationalist Mossadegh. Imperialism works through sections of the Iranian bourgeoisie and petty bourgeoisie, including, no doubt, disaffected sections of the Islamic Republic's establishment, eager to secure their wealth and privileges by functioning as direct imperialist agents. These elements are viciously hostile to the plight of the oppressed masses, as exemplified in the prominent protest slogan, "My heart beats only for Iran, not for Gaza, not for Lebanon." The protesters' targeting of Afghan refugees, an increasing embrace of the Pahlavi dynasty. Due to the misrule of the Islamic Republic and the political confusion spread by the pseudo-left in and outside Iran, who call for unity with far-right forces in the name of democracy, tragically some workers and students have no doubt been caught up in the ongoing protest and state repression. But as the World Socialist website previously explained, quote, any progressive tendency in Iran would have to immediately repudiate Trump's support, denounce the threat of imminent U.S. military action, and call for the immediate lifting of the punitive sanctions that are strangling Iran's economy. From all indications, as the pro-imperialist character of the protest has become clear, they have become restricted to more privileged sections of Iranian society. Within the working class, the memory of the Shah's regime, its subservience to U.S. imperialism, monopolization of the country's wealth, and the brutal repression upon which it rested, endures. Those now expressing their horror and revulsion at the brutality of the Iranian regime have not been moved by the ongoing slaughter of tens of thousands of Palestinian men, women, and children in Gaza, to say nothing of the Nazi-style starvation of the entire enclave's population, perpetrated by Israel, with the full support and military assistance of Washington, first under Biden and now Trump. As in Venezuela, at the beginning of the year, the Trump administration is acting with utter criminality and recklessness. However, more than criminality connect the attack on Venezuela and the regime change operation, and an impending military attack targeting Iran. They are part of a developing world war. The U.S. is seeking to seize hold of the world's oil resources in preparation for military confrontation with China. China imports more than 70% of its daily oil consumption, with Iran accounting, according to various estimates, for 11% or more of all Chinese imports in 2025, and Venezuela's 3-4%. Losing access to Iranian oil would be a significant economic and strategic shock to China's independent industrial base. Workers must be warned. U.S. imperialism is on the verge of launching a new war against Iran, whose consequences are incalculable. In threatening Iran, Secretary of State Marco Rubio has stated, "When Trump says he'll do something, he means it." End quote. Trump has repeatedly vowed to unleash military fury against Iran, just as he has pledged to rule like a dictator. "I don't need international law," Trump told the New York Times last week. The only thing that can stop me, he continued, is my own will. In reality, there is something that can stop him, the international working class. Even as Trump prepares for war on Iran, 15,000 nurses are on strike in New York City, the largest nurses' strike in the city's history. In France, hundreds of thousands have struck against austerity. Italy saw a general strike in November. Belgium's workers walked out against the country's coalition government. From Germany to the UK to Latin America, the objective conditions for a global movement against capitalism and war are emerging. As the WSWS wrote in its New Year statement, the ruling class has made clear what they want 2026 to be, a year of unrestrained military violence. The answer must be to make 2026 a year of class struggle and the development of a mass movement for socialism. End quote. This depends on the building of new leadership in the working class, rooted in the principles of Marxism and armed with a strategy of permanent revolution, to forge its political independence and unify its struggles across state boundaries and continents. I wish we could pull everybody together and do a general strike. New York City nurses speak out on their struggle, second day into strike, by Elliot Murtaugh, Steve Light, and Robert Milkowski. On Tuesday, 15,000 nurses at four hospitals in New York City continued their strike into its second day. Nurses are fighting for safe staffing levels, which was also a key demand in their three-day strike 2 years ago, as well as adequate health benefits, which enable them to afford their own health care. Reports have come out that Mount Sinai management fired three labor and delivery unit nurses on the eve of the strike by voicemail in an act of intimidation. The fired nurses claim that after they refused management's demands that they train the travel nurses who would replace them if they went on strike, they were falsely accused of hiding supplies and fired without any investigation. The strike has won enormous support among workers in New York City and across the country, reflecting deep-seated anger over inequality and worsening conditions. The nurses' strike emerges as an initial flashpoint in what could develop into a far wider confrontation between workers and the corporate and political establishment. This year alone, hundreds of thousands of workers in New York City face contract expirations, including roughly 150,000 municipal workers in AFSCME District Council 37, whose contract expires November, and some 37,000 subway and transit workers in Transport Workers Union Local 100, whose contract expires on May 15th. The strike raises the necessity for its expansion into a unified movement against social inequality, bringing the organized power of the working class into direct conflict with the financial oligarchy, which is centered in New York City and has the Trump administration at its head. Rather than allowing struggles to be isolated and defeated one by one over the course of the year, workers must seize the opportunity created by the nurses' strike to begin coordinating a broader offensive, culminating in a city-wide general strike now. The issues in the strike, safe staffing, healthcare, wages, and basic living standards, can only be resolved through a frontal assault on the privileges and power of the corporate ruling elite by a movement of the entire working class. Such a perspective requires that workers themselves take the initiative. NYSNA, the New York State Nurses Association, officials are already repeating their role from 2023, when they abruptly called off a strike at 11 of the 15 hospitals involved, isolating other nurses and shutting down the struggle after just 3 days. Nurses must be on guard against a repeat of this betrayal. Workers in other unions must likewise not accept mere verbal support on the part of their own officials, but fight for joint actions. To prevent the strike from being sold out, rank-and-file nurses should form independent strike committees to assert democratic control over picketing, contract negotiations, and the direction of the struggle, and to actively reach out to other sections of the working class in New York City and nationally for unified support and joint action. Reporters from the World Socialist website spoke to nurses on the Mount Sinai East picket in Midtown Manhattan on Tuesday about their struggle. A pediatric intensive care unit, or a ICU nurse, spoke about the effects of understaffing. Quote, "When our unit is understaffed, the shift is very hectic and sometimes very unsafe. It's the same on any unit in the hospital. In the ICU, we're lucky with better ratios, but when we have surges, like with RSV and respiratory viruses, sometimes I can go up to 3 patients per nurse. In other units, especially in the adult side, nurses can have 4, 5, 6, 7 patients when they're understaffed. A lot of the risks involve efficiency in care. If you have too many patients, you're less likely to catch signs of decompensation quickly. So if a patient's going to need increased care or they're getting sicker, sometimes you won't be able to catch that early because you're caring for all your other patients. This strike right now is a perfect example of how the hospital says they don't have enough money. But they do. They're paying the scab nurses $10,000 a week to work the strike, while saying they can't afford to pay the nurses' health insurance. And so really, it's a question of where they want to put that money. And they clearly don't want to put it into their own nurses. I think the way they see it is that they would rather keep that money for their profits and for their millionaire CEOs. I think in a country like the United States, where you don't have the guaranteed health insurance, you're going to be sicker. We have a huge disparity in access to preventative care in this country. When people can't have primary preventative care, they rely on the hospital systems a lot more. A lot of people can't access healthcare outside of the emergency room, and so the hospitals are heavily burdened with more patients because of this. So patients get sicker, their health is neglected, and then the strain appears in the hospital." End quote. She also said that the Mount Sinai has a VIP unit in the hospital for the wealthy. Quote, "The rooms are much bigger. They have a concierge kitchen for them. It's terrible, and the people are really going to hurt. It's not going to affect the upper class. It's going to affect all the other Americans, working class Americans. And honestly, we're the people who keep the country afloat. And if our health can't be protected, the country's going to struggle." End quote. An oncology nurse spoke about her experience with her own healthcare coverage she receives from her job. Quote, "When I started at Mount Sinai a couple years ago, I loved my job, and I was very excited to be here and part of the institution. I got pregnant, and then found out that the maternity leave is 7.5 hours total. I worked 12-hour shifts, so I had to take vacation to literally give birth to a baby and was in the hospital for a week. That's not good healthcare. That's not what we tell our patients, that they need to take time to heal. And that's not how we should be treated either. There's always been a big, big discrepancy between the haves and have-nots in New York. You have the very, very rich, and you have the not wealthy. And somehow now, I think when you look at it and affordable rents, your income has to be like over $150,000. That's insane for most people. They can't afford that." End quote. A neonatal intensive care unit, or a NICU nurse, explained, "When we're short-staffed, we can have like 26 nurses for up to 60-plus babies. We can have 3 babies plus assignments on our lower acuity side, which is not safe. And our high acuity side, you can have an intubated baby paired with another patient. You just can't focus and really pay close attention to anything that's going on with your assignment. That puts our babies and their families at risk, and that's why we're out here protesting for them." End quote. A preoperative nurse working in the operating room for the last 7 years declared short staffing, quote, "is dangerous for patients and staff. I haven't had any incidents, but I've seen patients attack staff. We don't have any security on the floors, so we have to deal with that on the floors. They terminated our health insurance, so currently we have no health care. I'm forced to go into rooms where patients have all sorts of things, and I don't have coverage in case I get sick. This was not because of the strike, but since January 1st, Anthem and the hospital could not come to terms with pricing. It affects the patients coming into the hospital because if I get sick, I pass it on to my patient. My patient passes it on to the next person. It's unsafe conditions in there. I can't heal myself or take the time I need because they're trying to cut back on that. But in every hospital you go to, you'll see a VIP suite. Even though all patients in my eyes are VIP and get special treatment, VIP suites are like hotel rooms. There is definitely a connection with government healthcare cutbacks. That is what the hospital complains about. The new pricing is because of the cuts the president has made. The Democrats are not doing anything fighting back whatsoever." End quote. Asked about expanding the strike, the OR nurse said the following, quote, "I wish we could pull everybody together and do a general strike. I think we would win. We would make some changes, but it has to be unity, getting everybody to do it." End quote. Word of the strike has also spread widely to healthcare workers across the country. In San Diego, UC Health Hillcrest Hospital workers expressed strong statements to the WSWS in solidarity of New York nurses. One resident said, "The residents are in solidarity with the nurses and definitely support their struggle for better staffing and wages. Nurses' safe staffing is important to being able to provide quality care to our patients." Another nurse stated, "I completely support it, for better wages, and especially if it's over safe working conditions." End quote. Trump doubles down on threat to seize Greenland, as Danish foreign minister set for talks in Washington, by Jordan Shilton. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio are scheduled to meet at the White House Wednesday with Danish Foreign Minister Lars-Løkke Rasmussen and Greenland's Minister for Foreign Affairs Vivian Motzfeldt. The meeting takes place amid escalating threats by U.S. President Donald Trump to seize Greenland by military force, prompting European politicians and analysts to warn of the end of the NATO military alliance. Trump has repeatedly insisted on Washington's need to seize control of Greenland, a message he reinforced in an interview with The Atlantic earlier this month. He asserted that the island was needed, quote, "for reasons of national security," pointing to alleged threats posed by Russia and China. The U.S. has had continuous military presence on the island since World War II and retains the Pituffik Space Base, which is crucial for missile defense. Trump's determination to take over Greenland is part of his so-called Donroe Doctrine. Outlined in last November's National Security Strategy, it vows to eliminate all, quote, "non-hemispheric competitors" from the Western Hemisphere and give Washington unchallenged domination over the area's raw material and trade routes, as well as the governments of other states. Taking control of Greenland, which lies off the Canadian East Coast, would strengthen Trump's push to integrate Canada as the 51st state of the U.S. This America First policy has produced a deep rift in the post-war transatlantic alliance. The European imperialist powers, which long relied on U.S. hegemony to pursue their own global interest, now find themselves targeted by Washington as competitors in a new redivision of the world. Trump's seizure of Greenland would spell the end of the alliance, an outcome the European powers are desperately trying to avoid, because they are not yet ready militarily to act independently without U.S. support. German Foreign Minister Johann Wadenpohl declared Sunday, prior to departing for Washington for talks with Rubio, that NATO should assume a greater role in the Arctic, and that only Greenland and Denmark should determine Greenland's sovereignty. Quote, "Security in the North Atlantic is a special responsibility for us. It's not just in NATO's name, but it is also very important strategically for our common security." End quote. Underlining Berlin's own aggressive ambitions in the Arctic region, Wadenpohl paid a visit to Iceland en route to Washington. The German armed forces, the Bundeswehr, signed a declaration of intent with the North Atlantic island last year that it will allow the stationing of German aircraft and naval vessels in Iceland. Wadenpohl stressed the strategic significance of the Greenland-Iceland-United Kingdom, or the GIUK gap, a stretch of water that serves as one of Russia's last remaining access routes to the open sea. Notwithstanding Trump's brazen threat to seize its territory, which it ruled as a colony until 1953, the Danish government is also continuing to plead for a renewal of its alliance with Washington. At a press conference before his departure for Washington, Foreign Minister Lars-Løkke Rasmussen wore a pin displaying a Danish and American flag side by side. Social Democrat Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen emphasized at a separate press conference with Greenland's Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen that Denmark was prepared to spend more on Arctic security. Asked how she could persuade Trump not to take over Greenland, Frederiksen responded that Denmark could do so by being a, quote, good ally, as Denmark has always been. Further spending on Denmark's military, which has already risen sharply over recent years, will be paid for by public spending cuts and a tax on the working class. Copenhagen is already committed to purchasing an expanded fleet of F-35 fighter jets to facilitate Arctic operations, new ships, drones, and radar systems to patrol Greenland, and a new headquarters to expand the Army's Arctic Command on the island. Denmark's defense spending rose by 80% in 2025, reaching 68 billion kroner, or 9.1 billion euros, compared to 37 billion in the previous year. The European powers have postured as defenders of international law in the face of Trump's threat to resort to military force to own Greenland, if necessary. Last week, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, and Spain issued a joint statement with Denmark, declaring that they would all uphold the principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen stated that law is stronger than force, while Council President Antonio Costa asserted, quote, "Nothing can be decided about Denmark and about Greenland without Denmark or without Greenland," end quote. This is utter hypocrisy. The European powers have never shown any concern for international law when violating it suits their imperialist interest, such as the carve-up of Yugoslavia or NATO's involvement in the neo-colonial occupation of Afghanistan or air bombardment of Libya. Earlier this month, they refused to explicitly condemn Trump's illegal abduction of Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro and his vow to run the South American country like a colony. The major European powers are desperately trying to retain some form of cooperation with the US for as long as possible, as they rush at breakneck speed to carry through vast rearmament programs to put them in a position to act independently of and even against Washington on the world stage. But these plans will still take several years to implement, and will inevitably provoke an explosion of class struggle, as governments across the continent eliminate what remains of public services and worker rights to pay for militarism and war. For the time being, they remain dependent on U.S. logistical and military support to continue the war against Russia, which the European powers want to pursue at all costs. In addition to the breakup of the transatlantic alliance, what really troubles the European imperialists about Trump's seizure of Greenland is that they could be cut out militarily and economically from the Arctic region. Due to climate change, control over the Arctic is key for dominating new trade routes opening up as ice melts. Moreover, a U.S. takeover of Greenland would not only give Washington ownership over the island's rich natural resources, but also Denmark's claim to the territorial waters in the Arctic Ocean, which include oil and gas exploration rights under the seabed. The European powers hope to avert this outcome by expanding NATO's involvement in the region. The Financial Times reported that Britain, France, and Germany are in talks to create an Arctic Sentry exercise, modeled on the Baltic Sentry operation established earlier last year under German command, aimed at strengthening surveillance of Russian vessels in the Baltic Sea. Arctic Sentry would include U.S. troops in a bid to mollify Trump's concerns about a lack of security in Greenland. At the same time, European politicians have acknowledged openly that an American seizure of Greenland would spell the end of the NATO military alliance. Quote, "If you turn your back on cooperation by threatening an ally, something we've not seen before, everything comes to an end," said Fredrickson on Sunday. Armin Laschet, a member of the governing Christian Democrats in Germany and chair of the German Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, commented, quote, "We have to make clear to the Americans in diplomatic talks that military action against a small NATO country would destroy the remaining trust in the alliance," end quote. None of the contending parties have anything progressive to offer the population of Greenland or the working class throughout Europe and the U.S. An American imperialist takeover of the island would mark a further step in Trump's mad plan to dominate the Western Hemisphere as the foundation for world war against Washington's rivals, above all China. Some sort of compromise, under which Greenland remains nominally part of the Kingdom of Denmark, would be based upon a huge expansion of U.S. and NATO military activity in Greenland and throughout the Arctic, turning the entire region into another front in a rapidly escalating Third World War. The only way to stop the revival of imperialist barbarism on both sides of the Atlantic is through the construction of a working-class-led anti-war movement based on a socialist program. Workers in Europe and the United States who are bearing the full cost of militarism and war through job cuts, austerity, and attacks on their social and democratic rights must unite to put an end to the capitalist profit system, the root cause of war and imperialist plunder. You can find all this and more at the World Socialist website, wsws.org. This has been Archie Stone for the World Socialist website.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.